name's David and I'm an alcoholic. And as I think Kai said, my home group is A Vision for You in London on a Wednesday. And I came to the fellowship in December 1988, and I haven't had a drink since then. And the reason that I feel I haven't had a drink is that I've done my best to follow the suggestions that were given to me, which were in accordance with the principles of the AA program, and the AA program works. And in general, the result for me has been that I don't drink and I have happy days. And really, if I wanted to summarize that, that is the result. And it's, in fact, it's better than that. It gets better steadily. If you were to chart the graph, the happy graph, it would go steadily upwards, you know, a few sort of bumps along the way, but it's still getting better. I came to AA at the age of 26, and at that point, it felt like that was the sort of the end of my life, or as good as. I've heard sort of many stories in AA, and in comparison with most, or with many, I represent what you call a high bottom. Many of the things that happen to alcoholics physically yet to happen to me. Just to sort of give you a sort of feel for how I was, I started drinking. I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember any sort of great epiphany when I had my first taste of alcohol or anything like that. But I started drinking steadily when I was 18. I went away to college. And for me, it was just, you know, I felt as though I hadn't done all the things that 18-year-olds were supposed to have done by the time they're 18. And suddenly, here I was, part of the crowd. You know, when men had joked about what had gone on the previous evening in the next day, I knew what it was the jokes were about. I was part of it, and it's the first time I'd felt like that. And furthermore, I found out, in comparison with the others, I was quite good at drinking as well. So it was nice to find something I was good at. And it worked for me for a few years. My recollections of my college days are still very happy ones. I don't have a great sort of history of police cells or anything like that. The nearest I got to getting a police record is when I was a student and I tried to pinch a road sign, and the police car that was parked 15 yards away, I hadn't noticed, just rolled down the window and shouted at me in a very bored tone to put it back. So I turned round and put the road sign back, and that was the end of my life of crime. And right up until the time I came in, I never got into any serious trouble. However, inside, I knew that there was something wrong. Steadily, I was drinking more and more. I just about scraped through each level of being a student, more and more difficult each time. And I knew that I didn't want to hold down a job, because I just, you know, when you're a student, you can just miss lectures the next day, or that's, you know, that's the student life I led. Anyway. And I managed to stay a student until I was 25, and it really wasn't because I was a good student. You know, I just drifted from one thing to the other. And by the time I got to the age of 26, I'd been in my first job for about 9 months. I was living in London, and I'd been there for about 6 or 7 months, something like that. And on the face of it, I had everything that I thought was worthwhile. You know, I had another girlfriend. I want to say another one. Not that I had a lot, but just the... I didn't, you know, the ones I had, I didn't have them for very long, was my history. And she was everything I wanted. I had the job that I thought was perfect, and I was miserable as anything. And I didn't know what to do, and I just felt that I wanted to drink all the time. And the thing was, I'd been trying to control my drinking. I knew that if I drank as I wanted to, I just drank till I passed out. That was fun for me. And I knew also that I couldn't do that as much as I wanted to if I was going to hang on to this, this semblance of normality that I had. And I was struggling to hold down the job. I was lying about why I was missing days, taking days off, why I was obviously below par. And you can only joke about a hangover once or twice, and then after that you're hiding it. Now, these are not serious things in many people's life, but for me, this was, you know, I knew that I didn't want to be doing this. But the main thing that really sort of bothered me was the fact that I knew inside I felt desperately miserable and lonely, and nothing could alter that, and except for drink. And it was getting to the stage where the drink wasn't doing it either. And I had this, I could see these two paths ahead of me. And one was to try and seek some sort of psychiatric help. So I thought about that. Another was to actually to drink more. And I remember my last New Year's resolution before I came to AA was not to give up drinking. It was to get drunk more often. And it may seem like a sort of funny situation. All this was sort of going inside my head. I was an alcoholic who wasn't really treating the disease in either of the ways that give any sort of comfort. I wasn't drinking enough, and I certainly wasn't doing the program. And I was extremely uncomfortable. And as I say, one route was just to give up on all this responsibility, forget about trying to hang on during these periods of dead time, which were the times between when I got drunk, which just seemed to be pointless. You know, I the whole time in between, I was just thinking about the next time I could get drunk. So the answer was just give up on responsibility and just drink. And I used to go past and see people on the streets of London who obviously were in real trouble, and part of me was envious. Because I thought, well, at least, you know, they're just drinking, they don't have the responsibilities. None of these things which I'm supposed to be working towards are giving me any satisfaction whatsoever. I simply cannot see the point. And I really did wonder whether I just expected too much from life. Perhaps life is just a lonely business and I hadn't realized it yet. Perhaps I was up to this point, I've been a hopeless idealist. That stage, I was beginning to drive people away, but I still had friends, I still had a social life, and the way that it felt to me was it didn't matter how lively the company, how entertaining the company, you know, you'd have a laugh, but it didn't seem to affect, deep inside, I felt bad, and it didn't really touch it. It didn't matter how intimate the relationships I had were. It didn't stop me feeling lonely. And I just didn't know what to do next. I say the drink was beginning not to work. One of the options was just drink more. Just go for it. Forget about everything. And fortunately, I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and one or two people had made mention of it to me. And up to that point, I just discounted the idea. I just laughed off the idea that I had a drinking problem at all. I was always curious, though. Whenever I used to answer those sort of questionnaires you get in women's magazines in the dentist's waiting room, which is the only place I would admit to reading them. You know, are you an alcoholic? And you get these sort of ticks. And I always came out as an alcoholic every single time. But I just assumed that what they were doing, this was a setup. The government was trying to reduce the bill for the National Health Service. And so, if they persuaded people they were drinking too much, then, you know, that would lower the sort of number of admissions to accidents and emergency. And, you know, I just thought, well, obviously that's why they're doing it. It never occurred to me that it might actually be revealing some truth until the end. And so finally, in desperation, I just thought, I've got to do something about this. Life is not meant to be this unhappy. And I thought about going to a psychiatrist or getting to some sort of self-help group. I'd heard about this therapy group in Islington. I don't know if any of you know London at all. Islington is quite a trendy area. Tony Blair lives there. I quite fancied the idea of that because that seemed sort of bohemian and arty and interesting, but it cost money and I couldn't afford it. I thought about going to my doctor, but I didn't want my health card, you know, my national health card stamped with mental case. That didn't suit my self-image at all. So I did the only thing which seemed open to me, which was write to somebody called Claire Rayner. Now, if I was in England, everyone would know who this person was. She is the sort of main TV agony aunt, you know. The American version is Dear Abby. I don't know who the Danish version is, but, you know, somebody you write to in magazines, dear, you know, you make your name up and stick a false name at the bottom of the letter. And I told her what my problems were. And I told her that I was desperately lonely and unhappy. And the main reason was that I was male and born in Britain. And I didn't know how to express love because I was too stiff upper lip and, you know, I wasn't emotional enough. And I never once mentioned drink. And she wrote back to me and said, you know, this is a very common problem in Britain. Can I publish your letter? Thank goodness I made the name up. And here's a list of psychiatrists. And I looked down this list and I just thought, I can't do this. And finally, I did the right thing, which people have been suggesting to me, which is to phone up Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way that I viewed it at the time was that I just had this image. It just suddenly dawned on me, and this is the thought process at the time, that all the relationships and friendships that I had since I was 17, 18 and gone to college had been made while drunk. So I thought maybe, you know, that it's being drunk is good for breaking the ice, you get to know people, but somehow it's flawed. You can only go so far and then it stops. And you can't go the whole way and get full satisfaction. So I've got to go back to being not drunk and learn how to do it, go back to being 17 again and work my way forward from that. And the first thing to do is to give up drinking. And I imagine that what would happen is that I'd learn how to stop drinking and then develop a social life through AA where they organised theatre trips, you know, where the coach picked you up, the coach driver sort of ushered you out, stood over the entrance to the bar, make sure you didn't go in, sort of counted you back onto the coach, and then through that you made friends and you learned how to do it without drinking. As you can tell, I had no idea about the disease of alcoholism at all. No idea of the hopelessness of my plight. And the one thing I do remember thinking about my drinking, I tried to stop so many times, and there were two things I was aware of. One was that this drinking pattern that I had, I drank just about daily. I didn't get drunk daily, but I got drunk more often than I wanted to. But it seemed to be imposed on me from outside. I couldn't break out of it. It just seemed to be something that I did despite myself, and the harder I fought against it, you know, inevitably I'd be back there doing it again. And the other thing was that it was getting worse, and I'd had an uncle who had died of alcoholism at the age of 43, caught pneumonia and died in 24 hours, and he weighed 5.5 stone. I don't know what that is in pounds, but, you know, he was emaciated, he was thin, and it was a tragedy. And I just had this, I could see myself going in his direction. I didn't understand the degree to which all my problems were just one problem, alcoholism. So I got to my first meeting, and I thought that I'd have to sort of explain what I was doing there. I turned up to my first meeting in a suit. I went to a meeting that was nowhere near where I lived, nowhere near where I worked. They offered the chance, I phoned the office and they offered the chance for someone to come round to my flat in West London to have a chat with me and take me to my first meeting. I turned that down flat because I just did not want the Alcoholics Anonymous van parked outside my apartment. What would the neighbours think? Not that they really would have cared. You know, I was one of these people that you know, was promoting world peace but couldn't talk to his neighbour, you know, the sort of person. So I eventually went to this meeting, and I was really struck by the stories of everybody. I can remember just one or two little details. Walking up to the entrance, and just at the last moment, sort of hesitating and thinking, what am I doing? This can't be. And somebody said, are you looking for the AA meeting? So I said, yes, and that was too late. I couldn't really back out. And it felt as though I was being sucked in. I realized that the process that was going on was that there were greeters at the door shaking my hand saying, oh, you're new. How do you know that? Come in, here's a cup of tea, sit down, somebody talk to me. There's this sort of whirl of activity. I'm 6'1" or something, but I had this impression of all these sort of faces bearing down on me, surrounding me from above, and I just couldn't escape. They seemed sincere, and if I'm honest, I just felt a little bit sorry for them, that these poor people, they were so enthusiastic about this. So deary me. So I just went with the flow, and I listened to the story. And a lot of what I heard, of course, I listened. I was told to look for similarities, and all I heard was differences. But I heard enough to go back to my second meeting, and it was about my second or third meeting that I heard somebody in this position here, which we call the chair in England, and it made an impression on me in a way that I hadn't. No other speaker had. She just started out by saying that Alcoholics Anonymous had saved a life as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd had a spiritual awakening. She didn't care who knew that, because this is what now made life worth living. And I'd never heard anyone talk about something like that in such a matter-of-fact, straightforward way before. I'd noticed the steps, and I'd not really registered that they would have anything to do with me. They have those scrolls. I don't know if I presume you have them in Denmark. The big sort of display scrolls with the steps on them. But she just talked about how that she'd done these things called the steps, and her life had changed. And the reason that I took notice wasn't just what she was saying, it was the way she was. You could tell either she was a complete liar or, she was a very different person from the person who had come in. She just sparkled. And that's when I first got an idea that there was something amazing on offer here. And I just fell in with this crowd and went to the meetings that they went to. They seemed friendly, and I just developed this circuit of meetings. And I found out pretty quickly how to get what that person got, or this is the way it was presented to me. And they just said, if you want what we have, the answer is to do the steps, and the best way to do that is to pick a sponsor. Just ask somebody who has experience of the steps himself to show you how to do it. And get somebody, they said, who has done the steps as they are in the big book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The way it was explained to me was that, just to emphasize how important it was that the organization was named after the book. It was called something else before the book was published. And they felt it was so important that that became the name of the organization. I don't know how true that is, but it certainly made an impact on me. That's what I did. I wanted what was on offer. I didn't really know very much about my disease at this stage. I asked somebody to help me, and we went for it. Now, I picked somebody who I didn't like particularly. He was from a different social background. He was a different age group. But people said he was a good sponsor. He had a way about him which I wanted. And I looked at his other sponsees, and he seemed to be able to pass it on to them. So I thought, well, I'll ask him. He also, it's actually, just to make a point, it's a good job that I didn't wait until I found somebody that I related to. because I'd still be waiting now. The truth is, I didn't relate to anybody before I did the steps. You know, there was always something wrong with everybody I met. So it would have been a lost cause from the start. So I just asked this guy, and I decided to trust him. And I heard that reference, actually, to the Taliban and big book Nazis. Our group's called All That and More. And it always strikes me the absurdity of the situation. I mean, I don't know, have you ever tried to make an alcoholic do anything? I mean, this is impossible. My sponsor couldn't make me do anything. I did what he said because I trusted him, because I wanted to know what he had to say, and I wanted what he was offering. And the reason I knew that if I didn't do what he suggested, that I wouldn't be following the path that he was on, and I'd be doing something else. So it just seemed to be silly. It's like, if I ask directions to, from London to Oxford or something, and they point to the M40, and so you say, that's the road, and you say, yes, but I want to go down the M25. It's just stupid. I can only go down the route which is going to take me to what I want. And I can't blame this guy and expect him to change the information because I don't like what he's saying. So I think that is important, that the trust is accorded by the one who trusts. It cannot be demanded by any sponsor, or it can be, but it is an impossibility for any sponsor to control anyone. It just cannot be done. And so that's another accusation, actually, controlling. I don't know if you've heard that word. It is an impossibility. And anybody is free to go to another group. People go where they want. There are no obligations. But I wanted what was on offer, and I decided, I made a decision to trust this guy. That was really the first decision I made. And through him and through listening, I got my first useful piece of self-knowledge. I mean, I was told, first of all, that self-knowledge wouldn't help me to stay sober. But there was some self-knowledge that was good. And if I made use of it, it would help me. And that was the knowledge that I was an alcoholic. But I had to make use of it. And the use of it is to do the steps, take the action afterwards. But I was... actually, the other thing that really registered with me that was said from here, which... I've enjoyed everything, actually, so far as I've heard it. Fantastic. But it was made clear to me that I should not share in meetings at that stage. I was told very directly to shut up and listen. I was told, you have nothing that we want to hear, is what they said. And I... as some of you feel that now, yeah. But this is what I was told. But later on, when I had some experience and some recovery, some knowledge of the AA program and the steps, which is a truth, it is just what you do to get sober. Then I was told that I must, actually, for my own. I was obliged to, for my own recovery, to carry the message. So I listened, and I have to say, actually, it was a relief. I didn't know what I was going to say. I was trying to listen, copy what others said. If somebody was emotional, I tried to be emotional, and it just wasn't me. And, it just felt very awkward in meetings. But to be told I didn't have to say anything was just fantastic, and I just listened. So I learned, first of all, about alcoholism, and the things that registered with me, these are the things that registered with me and my experience, were, first of all, this point that it's the first drink that does the damage. In other words, the craving is set off by that first drink. And I knew that was true for me because I could feel this sort of tingling. I remember having a drink and just almost being able to feel this sort of tingling in my arms, and I'd think, right, I've got the taste now, let's get going. So that registered. The other thing that registered was this description of the mental obsession. But one sentence in particular, it's referred to a number of times in the big book, but there's one sentence in particular that seemed to apply to me. And it says, it's the obsession of every abnormal drinker that one day they will be able to control and enjoy their drinking. And that just fitted me perfectly, because occasionally I could control my drinking. I didn't lose control every single time. You know, I still had a job, and I was just about hanging on to it. I mean, if I'd had perfect control, I wouldn't have been in AA. But as I say, I wasn't drunk every single time. Sometimes I stopped after the third pint or something. But I never wanted to. And whenever I controlled it, I never enjoyed it. You know, I wanted to drink until I passed out. But I knew I had to control it if I was going to be able to live this life that, you know, people painted as normal. You know, the job, the girlfriend. Oh, by that, I forgot to mention the girlfriend had got rid of me before I came to AA. The job and the girlfriend, but she wasn't in the picture. But this idealized image, I knew I had to control my drinking if I was going to have these things. And I just could not reconcile the two. I couldn't see how I was going to control my drinking and enjoy my drinking. Now, if you're not an alcoholic, that doesn't matter. It isn't an issue. But for me, I couldn't picture a happy life without being able to enjoy my drinking. And when I heard this, that it cut through everything. You know, I was worried, have I drunk enough? Have I suffered enough? But when I heard this, I thought, well, I know that corresponds to me. Deep down, that is me. And I knew that I was in the right place. The other thing that they impressed upon me, and I just had to take this on trust, but I'd heard enough people describing things that were similar to me to trust them, was that they said, if you start drinking again, it will get worse. And alcoholism always gets worse. And all the things that you're hearing the rest of us describe, the chances are they're going to happen to you if you start again. Alcoholism never reaches a sort of stable position. It's a disease that gets worse if you're drinking. And they made the point that, you know, even if you're not drinking, it seems that if you pick up a drink, you start off worse than when you came in. Now, I don't know whether that's always true, but I heard enough people coming back who said that was true for me to believe it. The other thing that really made me feel as though I was in the right place is when people described how they felt. It was the first time I'd ever articulated to anybody that sense of loneliness that I just talked about before. And every single person I spoke to seemed to say that they had that too. I just couldn't believe it. And they described it in different ways. They referred to it different, but they had that. The other thing that made me want to stay put was that when they talked about doing the steps, they said that went. This discomfort, this loneliness, this feeling of isolation, not only did it solve the drinking problem, it solved, well, it seemed to me, all my other problems. And that the way that it was put to me is that you have a lot of different symptoms. You know, if you asked me, I would have said drinking might have been sort of third or fourth. You know, the rest, well, you know, you could put all the others under the headings of either sex or money, but basically all the other problems, you know, they were as much on my mind. But they said, you know, if you're anything like us, and to be honest, you sound like you are, it's all one problem, and that's alcoholism. And the good news is that the steps will deal with that, and certainly that's worked for us. And then I started to hear people describe their experience. I started to look, and the guy that I picked as my sponsor, he was the one who made the most outlandish claims about the program. He said that since he started working the program, he never had a bad day. Now, he talked about having 3 heart attacks in sobriety. He walked with a stick. He was out of breath after 50 yards. But he sat in meetings and he looked at ease and he just said, I've not had a bad day in sobriety. I believed him. There was something about him that made me think that was true. And just let me tell you that I've discovered that possibility of a good day every day is there for anybody who does the program, I believe. Certainly, it is my experience. Whether or not I enjoy the day is down to me and what I do. It is not down to what happens to me. And for me, that's the great freedom of AA. It isn't just enough to be told that. I have to learn how to do it. I had to be shown. I had to be given the tools of the program to put into operation to be able to do that. And I'll explain a bit more about what that means to me today later on. But as I say, this guy made outlandish claims. He pointed to the promises in the big book and said, you know, this isn't sort of if you're lucky, these are promises. It's, you know, it's a guarantee. This life is on offer. And furthermore, it's a daily program. You know, if you don't do these things tomorrow, you might drink. But if you do them today, you ensure that you don't drink. But also, you ensure that you get these promises. It is within your grasp if you do these things. And he told me that misery is optional. Now again, I don't know whether I believed. I mean, part of me thought he's probably exaggerating just to try and sell the program to me. He's certainly well-meaning, and you know, he's even if it's sort of 75% true, it's worth doing. I did notice that there were others who seemed very unhappy, and some of them had been around a long time. The thing that I also noticed was that none of those people talked about doing the steps as they were laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So I picked somebody who had this happiness and also seemed to be able to point to a definite reason as to how he got it. As I say, I followed this course. I learned about my disease. I accepted that I was an alcoholic. I realized that I was powerless over alcohol. Actually, I should go into that a bit. I thought initially that being powerless over alcohol meant that when I took that first drink, remember I registered with that I couldn't control my drinking. And they said, no, it's not, for them, being powerless about alcohol is not about once you've taken that first drink. It's about the bit before you take the first drink. It's saying that if you know that once you take the first drink, and it's the first drink that does the damage, and that's, you know, and that's what caused the problem, if it was simply good enough to know, the answer is easy. Just don't take the first drink. Fine. Don't drink, go to meetings. That's the answer. But there is a problem, and they said, that if you are, like us, an alcoholic, and only you can decide, but if you're like us, in regard to alcohol, you are insane. You will take that first drink. You have no choice. There is nothing you on your own can do about it. Sooner or later, that time will come when you will have no mental defense and you will take the first drink. And I thought about that. And I thought, because, you know, I thought, well, I wasn't drinking constantly. And said, you know, that's not the point. The point is that at some stage you will take the first drink. And they pointed to the person who had a long gap in their drinking, and then started. And so I accepted that I was insane. I was powerless over alcohol. And from that point on, it was, in a sense, an admission of hopelessness. But I also accepted that there was hope in AA, and that hope lay in resorting to a power greater than me, a higher power. And that's what the rest of the steps were about. It's harnessing or allowing that higher power into my life so that it can save me on those occasions when otherwise I would drink. And as I say, my sponsor took me through the steps, and not just time is moving on. The details of which, it's uncanny, actually. I mean, I've been listening to the description of the steps today. And I have never been to the home group of Tom and Peter. I've never seen them before this weekend. And the way they have done it is exactly the same as the way I was shown. And the results that I got are exactly what they described. And you know, the one thing that unites us is the big book. This is what was impressed upon me, that if you do what's in the big book, you will get that result. Even down to the fourth step and the inventory and that fourth column, or you know, you might call it an extended third column, where you put your defects of character. What was wrong with me? Why? What was it in my reaction that made me feel as I did? No matter how just or unjust the action, what is it in me that feels bad? And as they said, this was the key thing that I discovered, that the problem was my self-centered reaction to the events that took place. And I listed every resentment I could ever remember having, some minor, some major, some against myself, some against others, some against God. I did an account of sexual conduct. I included thoughts in my head that I had resentments against myself. But I thought, if I ever told anybody these thoughts were whirring around in my head, I'd be locked up. And it refers to, I'm trying to keep it, the language delicate, but it refers to sexual conduct, both real and imaginary. And, you know, shall we say I had rather more of the latter in my step four. These were things that I'd never told anybody. I would not like to have admitted to it. And my sponsor did not throw me out of the room when he heard it. He just nodded and said, "You too." And in fact, I was rather insulted when at the end of it all, having sort of got all this off my chest, and at one point, by the way, he got up to make a cup of tea and said, "Carry on, carry on, I can hear you." So I read the stuff out. And I thought, oh, this will be a good time to sort of revert to some sex conduct, because he won't be able to hear me in the kitchen. At which point he shouted, I heard his voice go through, "Yes, speak up, I can't hear you." So I had to shout this stuff through to him. That was my fourth and fifth step, just as described. And I got that result. It was some time after the fifth step. I can't remember precisely when, but it wasn't exactly at the end of the final session. But I was just sitting in a meeting, and suddenly I noticed that loneliness and that isolation had gone. I felt part of what was going on in a way that I had never, ever, I don't think, felt before. Whenever I think that I'm having a bad day, I just remind myself of that, you know, the change that has occurred. As I go through this, I realise I've got to close. I'll close in a few minutes. I just want to explain. There's a number of things I should say. First of all, I'm just as powerless today as I was on the very first day. So I still have to do this sort of daily routine that I was given right at the start. Now, I sometimes hear people say that they only do the programme. I think it's a sort of an affected modesty or something. I only do steps, you know, when my back's against the wall and I'm pushed into the next one. Well, I had to face this when I was through the first nine steps. You know, things were going well, and I thought, you know, perhaps I can just coast a little bit. You know, I'm feeling good. I don't feel bad. I don't feel like I need a drink. Do I need to keep up this effort? I heard a story of this guy who, really, I heard his mistake and I learned from it. But he drank again. And fortunately, he came back in and he said what had happened. And he said that all that had happened, the only reason he drank was he stopped doing what suggested. And he said something that was really sort of struck home with me. He said, "I didn't even get a chance to feel bad before I had a drink." We are powerless. And if I wait until my back's against the wall before I do the next step, I might be drunk first. I have to feel good to stay sober, but I have to do more. I have to carry the message. I have to go to groups to, as was explained, to offer fellowship to newcomers. If I really accept that I'm powerless, I must do these things regardless of how I feel. It's not in response to how I feel. And the other thing is that this idea of we need never have a bad day, in London anyway, this used to cause such trouble, this guy used to say. And first of all, I'll say it is my experience. But the other thing I should say is that the program does not mean that it's not magic. It doesn't allow me to harness this force which manipulates everything to my liking. I don't suddenly have the job exactly that I want. Everything doesn't suddenly go my way. I have the sort of disappointments and difficulties that most people have in their life. But what the program enables me to do is to respond to those with dignity and to deal with the feelings that I have in association with it. So, as I heard someone describe, I can't help the first thought that comes into my head when something happens that I don't like, and very often it is resentment still. I think I'm a little better than I was, but I don't. Sometimes I despair how resentful I get. But now I can do something about the second thought. I can write inventory. I do step 10s daily. I can keep that stuff clear. If I'm fearful, I can remind myself that I've taken step 3. And also I can phone a newcomer. I can go and put some service into the meeting. There are things that I can do so that I don't need to feel bad about what's happening. And this is true even for sort of major things, deaths in the family. It doesn't mean that suddenly I'm pleased that this has happened. It doesn't mean that, I'm sort of dancing down the aisle at the funeral. What it does mean is that I, rather than feeling self-pity and thinking this has happened to me, poor me, how could my I'm feeling compassion and love for those affected. I'm able to be useful. And the bond of love between myself and those around me strengthens, even in adversity. And as they say, it's a design for living that works, even in rough going. And that is the truth for me. But it's a choice that I make. I have to choose each day to do these things. I'm amazed that I filled the time. I can't believe it. I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Yeah.